Turn your Bibles to the book of Daniel this morning. That's what we're going to be looking at in chapters 1 and 2 in the book of Daniel. Let's see if this works any better than it did a couple of weeks ago. Go ahead and show me my first slide, see if we actually got it to fit. Go ahead with the first one. Make all one line. I'm excited. Oh, it did too. If you were here a couple of weeks ago, you realized we were looking at a word called Christendom. But I got it all on one line. Christendom is the only experience you've ever known. It's the world of culture that you've grown up in, and you don't think it feels like it on some days. You'd wonder if you watch the news or you hear people talk or you just experience life in general, you wouldn't be convinced of it. But a world in which the Christian faith, the Christian doctrines, the Christian thinking has dominated culture is the world that you've grown up in, every single one of us. Until now. In our lifetime, as I look around this room, I would say in our lifetime, Christendom has come under threat. And it is much like a blanket that's knit together. When a knot comes out of it, you can just keep pulling. That thread just keeps coming apart. That's kind of where we're at. And you felt it. I felt it. We've experienced it. We've tasted it. We're seeing it happen right in front of them, right in front of us. This thing called Christendom, this idea that culture itself is dominated by Christian thinking, is kind of unraveling right in front of us. And it's become a huge threat for us. It starts back in the 3rd century when the emperor of Rome, despite the history where Christianity and Rome had been completely opposed, suddenly the emperor himself decides that Christianity, belief in Jesus Christ, would be the official religion of the Roman Empire. At that time, the biggest empire, most powerful empire in the world. And so Christianity goes from persecution to a place of prosperity and power and influence because the emperor says this is the religion that all of the empire should celebrate. And so for centuries, 800 years, we see this. Well, actually, since then, it's been almost 1,700 years since that time that Christianity has had a privileged place at the table. Kings and queens, heads of the state, were also heads of the church. And in the Western world, in Western culture, in North America, you were born Christian. You say, well, no, I've chosen to follow Jesus. But you were born into Christian culture. You were very likely, the odds are the vast majority of us in this room, were born into Christian family. So you were born Christian whether or not you chose it in some sense. The assumption has been in our culture that when you talked about God, you were talking about the Judeo-Christian God, the God of the Bible. And now anymore, that's not necessarily the case. I showed you a picture a couple of weeks ago of the gate at Harvard University, and how in that gate there's a stone plaque that basically says the reason we planted the school is so that the ministers of our churches would be educated enough to teach. That was the reason and the beginning for Harvard. In fact, the majority of schools and hospitals that are established in our North American culture were planted by the church. So this is what we've grown up in. By the way, Christendom has been our experience in the Western world. It is not a worldwide experience. There's places, pockets in the world where Christianity has never had a place of standing. Not surprisingly, these are also the places where we see the followers of Christ being more committed than ever. So we grew up in Christendom. It's what we're familiar with. But at the same time, nowadays, we're feeling it kind of slip through our fingers. And we're kind of standing around going, what's happening? What's going on? Why is this happening? I proposed to us a couple of weeks ago that this is not the first time the people of God has been kind of extracted from the center of culture. When we look at the story in the Old Testament of Israel, God sets them up as his favorite people on all the planet. Through Deuteronomy chapter 2 and 3, he uses the phrase, God gave. As Moses is recalling for them, just before they head into the promised land, Moses is telling them the story over and over again about how they got there. And he uses the phrase several times, God gave, God did, God accomplished. The point was this. Everything that we've achieved as a people of God and the favor we've had in the world, it's by God's hand that he did this. And the phrase that stands out is, God gave. It's in chapters 2 and 3 of Deuteronomy. He gave them prominence, he gave them purpose, and he gave them a public platform. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, he says to them, I didn't choose you as my people because you were powerful, or because you were exceptional, or because you looked like you were going to dominate anyway. You, in fact, you as a people, Israel, were the smallest and most insignificant group of people on the planet. And I chose you and gave you all this, not to prove you, but to prove me. So that's what he did. God gave them the platform. He also gave them a definition for that purpose, and he hearkened back to when he first called Abraham. When he called Abraham, this one man and his family, out of, by the way, Abraham was not a God worshiper. We find out in another text that Abraham's family, their descendants, they were pagan worshipers. And God called him out of pagan worship and said, Abraham, I want you to just go. And through you, I'm going to accomplish something that nobody could imagine. I'm going to bless the entire world. I'm going to bless you richly. You're going to be so multiple in number, you're going to bless the whole world. And then he reminds the nation of Israel, this was my plan all along. Well, this phrase in Deuteronomy 2, God gave, is the same phrase that Daniel uses in chapter 1 of Daniel 1. He says, God gave Israel into exile. And so we have this dichotomy we've got to wrestle through in our head. God picked a chosen people who were small and insignificant, had no power, had no influence, and he raised them up to be the dominant nation in their time and place in the Middle Eastern world. And then at some point later, he gave them into slavery and into captivity. We ask, what happened in between? Well, what happened in between, most of us have at least a subtle grasp on, is that over and over and over again, God said to Israel, I gave you this platform, you need to remain faithful to who I am. Deuteronomy chapter 28 is an entire chapter devoted to, if you follow after God, if you're serious about following God and you make the commitments, here's the blessings that are going to come to you as a people if you do this. And the second half of the chapter is the opposite. And if you are not going to be faithful to God, here's the curses that are going to come to you as a people. And in fact, in one of the phrases in Deuteronomy chapter 28, God says, if you fail to remain faithful, I will scatter you. I will put you into a land of captivity. You'll be slaves. You can't get the best of anything. So God was faithful to do exactly what he said. Well, I looked at that and I thought, maybe that helps us understand a little bit about what we're experiencing today. And I had a couple people come to me and say, I'm not convinced of it. I mean, is this truly exile that we are facing here today? In our culture, our church still enjoys the benefits of being identified as a charitable organization. So we get breaks from the government. We get tax breaks. At the end of the year, you get a tax receipt for all the money you gave to the church. And the church doesn't have the authority to give a tax receipt. That comes from the government. So the church already has certain measures of honor that we share and that we cooperate with our government. Clergy get a certain tax break through the government. And the church has certain standing with our government today. So you say, well, I don't know if it really feels like exile. I don't think this is actually God removing the church from their place of privilege. It might just be that our culture is becoming increasingly anti-God. We look around and we say the things that our culture wants to do and the direction it wants to go, it's just moving further and further away from God. Maybe that's all we're experiencing. Maybe in some sense, things are worse now than they've ever been before. And we just happen to be the people that, poor suckers we are, we're stuck in this time and place in history. And we're experiencing kind of worse than ever before. Well, I have a hard time buying that one, because if you read your history closely, you realize there was a time in which it was way worse than what it is now. More than one time in history, there's been times in which Christians have been persecuted far worse than this. I had one lady approach me a couple weeks ago after this introduction to the book of Daniel, and she said, it sounds to me like what you're saying, Pastor, is we have to throw our hands up and say, I guess we give up. And this church is kind of being pushed out of culture, and things are going to happen, so we shrug our shoulders and go play golf. Which is not a terrible idea, but that's another conversation. Do we just give up? I mean, is this language of exile a little bit too dramatic to be used? So let me change the question for us. Whether or not it's God is disciplining his church and God is picking up the church and removing them from dominance in culture, or whether or not culture is pushing the church out, or whether or not the church has just blown it and we deserve to be pushed out, all that aside, we are where we are now. We don't have the platform we used to have. We don't have the influence that we used to have. The question is not so much, why did this happen? How did we get here? It's, what do we do now? What do we do now? There was a time and a place when the church could decide to speak to an issue, a cultural issue, and it would have voice. We don't have that now, so what are we supposed to do? Whether or not it's God who's exacting discipline on the church, or whether or not the church has just been pushed out by others, how are we supposed to respond to this? What should our attitude of response be? Let me ask you this. What has our attitude of response been? when you think of the things that's happened in our culture, in our lifetime, some of the decisions that maybe our governments have made, some of the cultural things that have entered into our sphere, how many of us, when we were in public school, we said the Lord's Prayer every morning? It's gone, right? What has been our response to those changes? Has it been a polite humility that we learn from it? Or has it been an antagonistic, angry frustration? If you had to ask the question on the street, say, how do you think Christians and the church have responded to cultural changes over the last decade? You're going to find that most of the words that people would use to describe it are negative words. They've been embittered. They've been angry. They've been frustrated. I'm not convinced. Pardon me? We've been passive, but when we speak, right? Maybe we've been passive, we've let some of these things happen to us, but when we speak, it seems to me most often, we're not too happy about it. So I want to take a look at the book of Daniel, and I want to take a look at two things. What Daniel did in captivity, and probably more importantly, how he did it. So let's take a look at Daniel chapter 1. There's something I want to look at, what Daniel did and how he did it. There's two things we'll look at, one's in chapter 1 and one's in chapter 2. The first is that he refused the food that was given to him by the king. And the second one in chapter 2 is that he challenged the king's order of execution. And he did these things successfully, all as a captive. He did them from a place of inferiority. Let's look at first at Daniel chapter 1. I'm going to begin reading at verse 3. After they've been taken captive, read from verse 3, Daniel chapter 1. Then the king ordered Aspenas, king of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility. Young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning. If you're having a hard time kind of picturing, they were a lot like me. If you're under 30 here today, can you stand up? Oh, whatever. No, not if you think you're under 30. More like that. They probably more like that. Young men, no physical defect. You're astounding, Kyle. Just beautiful. Showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. Listen what was to happen to these young people. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. So they were given the best. There was all kinds of options for food in the land, but to be given the king's table's food is the best. They were given the best. They would be trained for 3 years, and after that were to enter the king's service. Not only were they robbed of their own practices of faith, taken into captivity, but while you're here, young men, who are so physically fit and so apt and so understanding, you're going to learn a new history. You're going to learn the Babylonian history. You're going to learn what our culture is about so that you can teach it to others. Among these were the men from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food, and he asked the chief official permission to not defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned you food and drink. If who should see you looking worse than the other young men, the king would then have my head because of you. Look at verse 6, because this is what Daniel did. Sorry, it's not in 6, it's in 8. This is what he did. Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. That sounds like a man of strong faith. Resolve. It's a line in the sand word. I'm going to dig my heels in. I'm not doing this. I will not do it. That's what Daniel did. But I want us to pay close attention to the next few words. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Really hard to measure together. How does someone take a hard stand on something, but then ask permission? Those two don't seem to work together, do they? What's amazing about it is that he didn't expect the Babylonian culture to respect his faith traditions. Daniel was in a place of inferiority. He was the captive. But he didn't expect the culture around him, the context around him, to follow after his traditions. I raise that point because the church is not where it used to be. We used to be at a place where we could expect it, but we're not there anymore. but our expectations haven't changed. We're now on the peripheral of society. We're now the underdog. We are captive to a Babylonian influence, and yet we still expect our cultural context to behave in ways that align with our faith. Should it? Of course it should. In God's design, the kingdom of God, there are certain things that should be true, but should we expect it? Daniel didn't expect it. He held on to his conviction, but he wasn't expecting. He didn't go to the king and say, no, you know, I have this tradition about my faith. There's only types of food I eat. And by the way, you all should practice it too. He said he held on to his conviction, but he did it in a very simple way. He resolved himself to the issue, but he humbled himself in expressing it. I wonder sometimes if the church has had a hard time with this. Being resolved to the issue, but learning how to be humble in the way we express it. Because that's what Daniel did. He held on to his conviction, but he did it in a way where he asked permission. He sought the king's heart after this. I think sometimes we see humility and being convicted of something as two separate things. But in fact, what we find by this, that humility is not the enemy of our conviction, it's actually the evidence of it. And it's not hard for me to find several other places in Scripture where this is the case. I'll jump to the most obvious example, and that's Jesus Christ himself. There was never a person who walked the planet who was ever more right than Jesus Christ. Any debate, any thought, any concern, anything that was happening, nobody understood it better, nobody knew the truer sense of reality than Jesus Christ himself. And yet, in the midst of being persecuted, in the midst of being lied about, he decided to say nothing. So humility, go ahead with this, humility is not the enemy of conviction, it's evidence of it. Now we might say, yeah, but culture doesn't respect humility. If we remain quiet, if we are careful about what we say, if we seek permission, people don't respond to that. If we approach our governments and say, we would like you to consider this, that's not the way, they don't respond to that. They respond to voices of power and influence. So the church has to band together and have a voice of power and influence. And yet we find that humility is actually the perfect expression of our conviction. You're right, culture does not respond to humility, but it's not our culture that we're looking to rescue us. It's the Spirit of God. The result for Daniel was wealth and favor with the king. But even as he tells the story, he's clear that this was accomplished by God. In verse 9, he says it this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. It doesn't say that Daniel was so impressive with his approach that the official was impressed with him. It says that God caused the heart of that official to respond to Daniel's humility. In verse 17, it says, God gave them knowledge and understanding, which prepared them to appear before the king and earn his favor as well. Let me read for you from verses 18 to 20. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, that is, at the end of their 3 years of training, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them to be 10 times better than the magicians and the enchanters of his whole kingdom. Of course he did, because they humbled themselves not only before God, but before the king, and God responded by giving them wisdom. Humility is not the enemy of conviction. And I'm not suggesting for one second that the church should fall away from its convictions that we have. I am suggesting we may need to find a new way to express them. Flip over to chapter 2. We'll look at another thing that Daniel did and the way that he did it. I'll give you a quick context for it. Nebuchadnezzar, who throughout the early chapters of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar is the roller coaster of unexpected. You never know what Nebuchadnezzar you're going to get from one day to the next. He responds to Daniel by saying, surely your God is the true God, and then flip the page and we find a completely different story. But in chapter 2, he's had a dream. And Nebuchadnezzar does something quite odd. The text doesn't explain why he did it. But he called his advisors and his counselors and he said, I had a really weird dream. And I need you to explain it for me. And they said, okay, that's what we're here for. What was the dream? And he said, no, I'm not telling you what the dream was. You need to tell me what I dreamt. And then you need to tell me what it means. And they said, can't do that. You can't read your mind. But if you tell us what the dream is, and Nebuchadnezzar said, no, you guys are so wise, you guys are so amazing, you tell me what I dreamed, and then you tell me what it means. He was a little bit unpredictable that way. I don't know what it would be like to have somebody in power who was unstable and unexpected. You never know what he's going to do. I'm not going there. This is Nebuchadnezzar. Unexpected. You never know what you're going to get. And he comes up with this unreasonable argument because no one can tell him what he dreamt. So verse 12, chapter 2, verse 12, we'll start there. This made the king so angry. This meaning no one could tell him what it was. No one could read his mind. Go figure. The king made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all of the wise men of Babylon. So he brings in a few for counsel and he says, read my mind. Tell me what I dreamt. And they said, we can't do that. He said, that's it. You're all going to die. Every single one of you who's got employment in the king is a wise person. You're going to die. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death. And men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends and put them to death. They were part of what considered wise counsel for the king. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. The NIV uses the words wisdom and tact. What an unusual moment. The indication is that Daniel wasn't one of the people who was there before the king saying, we can't do this. But by extension of being part of the wise men of counsel for the king, he now has to die. So here comes the king's guard to your door, knocking on your door, saying, because you belong to a certain group of people, which, by the way, we trained you for, you're going to be put to death. And Daniel says, he's got some options. You can run for your life, right? When those who have all the power say, we're coming to end your life, you can run. Or you can fight. You can figure out some way to get around it. Daniel, it says, the text tells us that he approached the commander with wisdom and tact. Because Daniel was so wise. The word wisdom and tact, it's interesting. The Aramaic words that inform this are this. The word wisdom is actually a word called to aim. And it means to intelligently reason. To give commentary to something. To have a back and forth. The root word for to aim is actually to taste. It's like the idea, literally, of finding a food and taking a little bit of it just to taste and see what it's like. And so the word to aim means Daniel gave him something to chew on. He gave him the phrase, what is the phrase we use? He gave him food for thought. So of all the options that Daniel had, fight, argue, run for your life, was it a just law? No, it wasn't a just law. It wasn't reasonable at all. All the people should not die because a few people couldn't read the king's mind. It was ridiculous. And Daniel could have made that point. This is a ridiculous law. How many times have we heard that said? This is ridiculous. They can't do this. The summer grant money is not meant to be used that way. That's insane. They can't do it. He could have made that argument, right? Instead, he has a conversation where he says, whoa, think about this for a second. He said to the commander, why did the king issue such a harsh decree? Arioch explained the matter, and Daniel went to the king and asked him for more time with wisdom and tact. And tact means this. The Aramaic is eta. It means he used caution and discretion. He used understanding and a mutually respectful dialogue. Daniel had a conversation with him. Now picture the moment for a second and know that there is a modern day application. The king has said or done something that just doesn't have any basis to it. It's ridiculous. It's silly. It's unfounded. It's not even a place where you can begin a rational dialogue. But somehow Daniel decides to create a rational dialogue. And he has a conversation with the king. I'm concerned that the church today, because things are going so, the blanket's coming unraveled, we're losing the art of having conversation. Because we can make claims about how ridiculous our culture is. And why would they move that way? I was watching last night, special on TV, all about the 80s and the 90s. The music of those times and what was happening in culture. And as you looked at it, you heard the expression of culture through music. The music of the 80s and 90s was angry, angry music. And you see the shift, and I think back, oh yeah, I remember that. I remember that band. I remember that time. I remember that event. And we've lost the art of having a conversation. And so Daniel still, he stuck to his ground. He stuck to the issue at hand, but he had a conversation. Verse 16, he went to the king and asked for time to interpret the dream. Did the king have the right to execute his order? Sure he did. He's the king. And Daniel went to him and didn't say, your order is ridiculous. Your order is unfounded. You're not being reasonable. He went to him and said, will you please give me time? Now, what's important about this is at that moment when Daniel is before the king, he did not have the answer in hand. He goes before the king and he says, give me time for this, because he knew his scriptures. He knew Proverbs chapter 15, verse 1, that says, a gentle answer can turn away wrath. So I'll step into this court respectfully and quietly, and I will ask if I have time for this. He chose humility and vulnerability. I hate vulnerability, and so do you too. We would rather be in a place of power, but Daniel chose to put himself in a place of vulnerability. He didn't know the answer, but he knew that he could trust God would reveal it. So he goes to his friends, verse 17. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men. Guys, we're in a really tough spot. This is not good. This could happen imminently. We need to pray. We need to pray hard. We need to get together and put this to the Lord. That is not our first reaction. Our first reaction, let's think about something, let's come up with something wise, let's do something. Daniel says, let's pray. Because God knows what this is about. And let me finish up this morning looking at Daniel's prayer in chapter 2. The story goes on to say that very night, God gave him the understanding. He gave him the vision of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and he explained it to him. And so here's Daniel's response. Listen to the power in these words. From a man who is in a place of captivity, from a man who is in the place of inferiority, he doesn't have cultural influence, his people are demolished, his people are pressed down, and he says this: praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power belong to us. What your text says? No. Wisdom and power don't belong to the church. Wisdom and power are accessible to the church, but they belong to God. Wisdom and power are His. He changes times and seasons. He sets up kings, deposes them. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells in Him. Thank and praise you, oh my God, oh fathers, you've given me wisdom and power. Daniel says, and he recognizes, and wisdom and power belong to God, that God changes the times and the seasons. We are not the source of truth. We are His ambassadors of truth. There's a difference between the president and the ambassador, right? 2 Corinthians chapter 5 says, we are ambassadors. Ambassadors don't make the rules. Ambassadors don't decide what happens. Ambassadors communicate what the king has decided. Daniel says, we are ambassadors here. He reveals the hidden things. And let's be clear about this. Sometimes the things are hidden from us as Christians just as much as they are to other people. Daniel knew that, which is why he said to his friends, we need to pray about this. We need to seek God's heart about this. It's troubling to me that Christians are often described as being arrogant. How did we get there? If Jesus was described as one who was humble and was a wise teacher, and generally speaking, even people who aren't Christ followers say, well, from what I know of the historical Jesus, he was probably a good teacher, probably a good guy in general. Then how is it that the Christians got labeled as being arrogant? We know what God reveals to us and no more. That's how much we know. So how do I know the difference? When we find ourselves in that place, whether it's culture in the big picture, or whether it's one-on-one interacting with my neighbor or a friend or a colleague, someone who's not of my faith, how do I know the difference from when I know or when I just have to wait on God? When we look at Daniel, we see this attitude of humility, commitment to prayer, seeking God. And we seek God. Daniel sought God to reveal the truth of the situation, not to confirm what he already thought. I find myself praying sometimes to God to make sure that God agrees with what I've already decided. God, I know what's right in this situation. I'm pretty sure I know what your word, but I've made up my mind about this. I just need you to get on side so I can go in. Guns blazing. How often are our prayers simply seeking that God would agree with us? Daniel prayed that God would reveal to him. So, do we throw up our hands? Daniel didn't. He remained resolved to the things that he knew were right. It's not right for me to eat that food. It's right for me to follow after this, but I'm going to do it cautiously. I'm going to do it with humility. It's not right for the king to have decided what he did, but I'm not going to go in and ream on. I'm going to go in and ask if we can have some time to work it out. It was a humility of approach. It wasn't sorted out by demands. Daniel learned how to have conversations with people that he disagreed with. most of us don't have that skill very well honed. How to have a conversation with somebody who thinks our faith is ridiculous. Why in the world would you be a Christian? That's just a crutch that people have to lean on because they can't deal with life. Faith is ridiculous. That's offensive to me. Faith has shaped my whole life. But I need to learn how to have a conversation with somebody that thinks that so they can see it in me, not just hear it, the words that come out of my mouth. We need to learn how to have conversations and respect our context. I read probably, I'm going to guess, 30, 40 different letters that were written this year when our government decided to shape the Canada grant situation the way it was. Quick context, most of you know this, but historically the government of Canada has given grant money to all kinds of organizations seeking to hire students. So churches were included in that. You want to hire a summer student? We'll provide you grant money for that. And up until this year, you filled out a form, you said, this is what the student's going to do for us, this is how long they're going to be employed, and the government would say, great, hire a student. The win for the government was young people got working for the summer. And this year in particular, they said, you can have the money if, here's the things you have to agree to. And the statements that the government included in the government grant this year, we could not agree to. We understood what they were trying to accomplish, but the words on the page were not something we could check the box and say, yeah, we're good for that. And so thousands of churches all over the country, because they could not agree to the statement that the government made, didn't get their summer grant. We didn't suffer by it. We figured out a way to make it work for us. Now, there's lots of Christian organizations that hire 10 and 12 and 15 students a summer, and they were hurt bad. It was wrong. I don't mind saying it. It was a bad move on the government. What they were trying to accomplish was understandable, but it was just poorly handled. It was wrong. It should never have happened. I read 20 to 30 different letters that people wrote to different other pastors and other Christian organization leaders. And of the number of letters that I wrote, there's about two that I would have signed myself. The rest of them were angry, embittered, accusations, and labeling our government and name-calling. And I thought to myself, this can't be coming from Christian people. I found about two in the whole bunch that I thought, wow, that's really well said. We raised the issue and said, this is the concern. This is what it appears like. Help us to understand. Can we have more dialogue? And that's the posture and that's the place I believe the church needs to be coming from today. How to respect our context when, in fact, we don't agree with our context. Can I ask our worship team to come on back up here with me? Be ready to help us respond this morning in the song. It's important that we keep in mind the scripture reading that we read this morning. God says to Isaiah, this is before the people of God were taken into captivity. He says this to them, I will not give my glory to another. I have a plan. I have an idea. I know what I'm doing. I'm steadfast and consistent in what I do. And I think sometimes as a church, we get so locked on the issue, on what's happening, the surrounding, we lose sight of the fact that God is steady, has been, and always will be. And if we lock ourselves on Him, we need not fear what's happening to the ground around us. So would you stand with us as we respond this morning and sing this song that recognizes the fullness of God? Let's do this together.